Out of the Silent Planet by C.S. Lewis, continuing on cassette number 7, side 1. Now, as to your most annoying question, did Augury, in describing the Eldalur, confuse the ideas of a subtler body and a superior being? No, the confusion is entirely your own. He said two things: that the Eldalur had bodies different from those of planetary animals, and that they were superior in intelligence. Neither he nor anyone else in Malacandra ever confused the one statement with the other, or deduced the one from the other. In fact, I have reasons for thinking that there were also irrational animals with the Eldil type of body. You remember Chaucer's Erish Beasts? I wonder, are you wise to say nothing about the problem of Eldil speech? I agree that it would spoil the narrative to raise the question during the trial scene at Meldilorn, but surely many readers will have enough sense to ask how the Eldila, who obviously don't breathe, can talk. It is true that we should have to admit we don't know, but oughtn't the readers to be told that? I suggested to Jay, the only scientist here who is in my confidence, your theory that they might have instruments or even organs for manipulating the air around them and thus producing sounds indirectly, but he didn't seem to think much of it. He thought it probable that they directly manipulated the ears of those they were speaking to. That sounds pretty difficult. Of course, one must remember that we have really no knowledge of the shape or size of an Eldil, or even of its relations to space, our space, in general. In fact, one wants to keep on insisting that we really know next to nothing about them. Like you, I can't help trying to fix their relation to the things that appear in terrestrial tradition, gods, angels, fairies, but we haven't the data. When I attempted to give Oyarsa some idea of our own Christian angelology, he certainly seemed to regard our angels as different in some way from himself. But whether he meant that they were a different species, or only that they were some special military caste, since our poor old Earth turns out to be a kind of equal salient in the universe, I don't know. Why must you leave out my account of how the shutter jammed just before our landing on Malacandra? Without this, your description of our sufferings from excessive light on the return journey raised the very obvious question, why didn't they close their shutters? I don't believe your theory that readers never notice that sort of thing. I'm sure I should. There are two scenes that I wish you could have worked into the book. No matter, they are worked into me. One or other of them is always before me when I close my eyes. In one of them I see the Malacandrian sky at morning, pale blue, so pale that now, when I've grown once more accustomed to terrestrial skies, I think of it as almost white. Against it, the nearer tops of the giant weeds, the trees, as you call them, show black. But far away, across miles of that blinding blue water, the remoter woods are watercolor purple. The shadows all around me on the pale forest floor are like shadows on snow. There are figures walking before me, slender yet gigantic forms, black and sleek as animated tall hats. Their huge round heads, poised on their sinuous stalk-like bodies, give them the appearance of black tulips. They go down, singing to the edge of the lake. The music fills the wood with its vibration, though it is so soft that I can hardly hear it. It is like dim organ music. Some of them embark, but most remain. It is done slowly. This is no ordinary embarkation, but some ceremony. It is, in fact, a frost funeral. Those three with the gray muzzles, whom they have helped into the boat, are going to Meldalorn to die. For in that world, except for some few whom the Hanakra gets, no one dies before his time. All live out the full span allotted to their kind, and a death with them is as predictable as a birth with us. The whole village has known that those three will die this year, this month. It was an easy guess that they would die even this week. And now they are off to receive the last counsel of Oyarsa, to die and to be by him unbodied. The corpses, as corpses, will exist only for a few minutes. There are no coffins in Malacandra, no sextons, churchyards, or undertakers. The valley is solemn at their departure, but I see no signs of passionate grief. They do not doubt their immortality, and friends of the same generation are not torn apart. You leave the world, as you entered it, with the men of your own year. Death is not preceded by dread, nor followed by corruption. The other scene is a nocturne. I see myself bathing with Hjoy in the warm lake. He laughs at my clumsy swimming. Accustomed to a heavier world, I can hardly get enough of me under the water to make any headway. And then I see the night sky. The greater part of it is very like ours, though the depths are blacker and the stars brighter. But something that no terrestrial analogy will enable you fully to picture is happening in the west. Imagine the Milky Way magnified, the Milky Way seen through our largest telescope on the clearest night. And then imagine this, not painted across the zenith, but rising like a constellation behind the mountaintops, a dazzling necklace of lights brilliant as planets, slowly heaving itself up till it fills a fifth of the sky and now leaves a belt of blackness between itself and the horizon. It is too bright to look at for long, but it is only a preparation. Something else is coming. There is a glow like moonrise on the Herandra. "Ahira!" cries Hyoi, and other baying voices answer him from the darkness all about us. And now the true king of night is up, and now he is threading his way through that strange western galaxy and making its lights dim by comparison with his own. I turn my eyes away, for the little disk is far brighter than the moon in her greatest splendor. The whole Handramit is bathed in colorless light. I could count the stems of the forest on the far side of the lake. I see that my fingernails are broken and dirty. And now I guess what it is that I have seen. Jupiter rising beyond the asteroids and 40 million miles nearer than he has ever been to earthly eyes. But the Malachandrians would say within the asteroids, for they have an odd habit sometimes of turning the solar system inside out. They call the asteroids the dancers before the threshold of the great worlds. The great worlds are the planets, as we should say, beyond or outside the asteroids. Glundandra, Jupiter, is the greatest of these, and has some importance in Malachandrian thought which I cannot fathom. He is the center, great Meldelorn, throne, and feast. They are, of course, well aware that he is uninhabitable, at least by animals of the planetary type, and they certainly have no pagan idea of giving a local habitation to Meleldil. But somebody or something of great importance is connected with Jupiter. As usual, the Serenae would know, but they never told me. Perhaps the best comment is in the author whom I mentioned to you. For as it was well said of the great Africanus, that he was never less alone than when alone, so in our philosophy, no parts of this universal frame are less to be called solitary than those which the vulgar esteem most solitary, since the withdrawing of men and beasts signifieth but the greater frequency of more excellent creatures. More of this when you come. I am trying to read every old book on the subject that I can hear of. Now that Weston has shut the door, the way to the planets lies through the past. If there is to be any more space traveling, it will have to be time traveling as well. This concludes the reading of Out of the Silent Planet by C.S. Lewis. This book was read by Grover Gardner. Will you please wind or rewind the tape as appropriate, so the book will be in order for the next person to enjoy. Thank you.